Anatomy and Physiology, the Digestive System and Metabolism, Part 3. Well, last time we left off talking about the small intestine, and remember that was a digestion and absorption machine. 90% of all nutrients and liquids get absorbed there. You cannot live without it. And remember, I like to think of it like a big shop vac sucking in all our nutrients after we've digested them. Now we're going to talk about some of the key accessory digestive organs. Remember, these are organs that generally shoot juice into the tube to allow the food to be digested and absorbed along its passageway. Let's start with the pancreas. You don't have to remember the numbers here. I'll trace it on your slide. It's about 5 inches long and about 1 inch thick, shown here kind of yellow in your picture from your book. It is described as having a head and a body and a little tail. And what's kind of cute is the head of the pancreas is sort of nestled right in the curve of the duodenum. If you saw a duodenum, either in a cat or in a human being, it's shaped like a little C. So I picture the duodenum like a little C-shaped cradle, and I'm just pretend I'm rocking the little baby head of the pancreas, and that way I never forget that anatomical setup. Another key feature on this slide is picture yourself having x-ray goggles on, look into the middle of the pancreas, and you see this big, long duct, and you got it. Some genius called that duct the pancreatic duct. And what is important here to note is the pancreatic duct, with all its special juices, hooked together with the common bile duct with all its special digestive juices, and it empties into the first part of the small intestine that you know is called the duodenum. And what a better place, that wasn't proper English, but you know what I'm trying to say, what better place to dump the juice than right here? I mean, if the small intestine is the digestion and absorption machine, where do you want to squirt all the magical juices? Do you want to shoot them at the end of the tube, like way down where the ileum is? Or do you want to put them up here where you just shove the whopper? Well, of course, it makes sense. You want to inject all the digestive juices from these organs right here at the beginning, at the top of the small intestine, so that those juices can do all their work as the food slips, slides its way on down the chute. So one more time, how beautiful is it that the design matches the purpose? Little bit of histology here, but I'm going to save this mostly for lab. If you cross-section the pancreas and slap it on a slide, here it is down here. Mostly it's made up of clusters of cells, and you know the name for cluster in anatomy is called, or they're called, acini, and 99% of the pancreas is made up of acini. Those cells make the pancreatic juice, which is rich in digestive enzymes, and it secretes those juices into ducts. The duct then takes the juice into the duodenum, as we saw in the other slide, and there's a name for a gland that puts its juice into a duct, which then takes it somewhere else, and that is called an exocrine gland. So this is the exo, E-X-O-C-R-I-N-E, portion of the pancreas. But the pancreas has another function that we'll talk about in another section of the course. In the pancreas, histologically, you find these roughly ball-shaped structures, little islands of insulin-making cells, I like to call them. They're really called pancreatic islets. They make up only 1% of the gland, but they make some really powerful and important hormones, including insulin and glucagon. And these hormones, after they're secreted, they go into the bloodstream. Yeah, they enter the circulation. And that is called the endocrine portion of the pancreas. We'll learn this during the endocrine section, that endocrine tissues put their products called hormones into the blood. By the way, you could put this part of the slide sort of off to the side in parentheses. I'm going to save the pancreatic islet questions for when we do the endocrine section. let's, of course, focus on the digestive portion. So the title of this slide has some key features in here. We must know the composition and function of the pancreatic juice. First of all, check out the pH, 7.1 to 8.2 with a star. No, I do not want you to memorize the numbers. What I do want you to know, is that a little bit acid or is that a little bit alkaline? And if you remember your pH scale we talked about, you know this is a little bit alkaline or a little bit basic. And that should make sense. Look at that last picture. Where are we shooting the juice? We're putting it into the duodenum right here where we're just shoving the acidic chyme from the belly. And please remember that none of our digestive processes, none of our digestive enzymes work in an acidic environment. So how beautiful is it that pancreatic juice has an alkaline pH to try to neutralize that strong acid from the stomach? So what is inside a pancreatic juice? Three basic key ingredients you should know. Number one, water. Well, yeah, whenever anybody asks you what any liquid in the body is made of, you could always say water is the number one ingredient, and you'd be right. But what are the big players I want you to know? Number one, bicarbonate, our old friend, our old ion, our old buffer, bicarbonate. Again, the purpose is to buffer the acidic chyme from the stomach so that our digestive enzymes can actually work. The third thing that's in pancreatic juice are digestive enzymes with triple stars. It would serve you well here to write down off to the side. Your pancreas is a big bag of digestive enzymes. You cannot live without the pancreas. If anybody ever asks you which enzymes in the body do the most of the chemical digestion, you will say the pancreatic enzymes, because that is what does most of the work. Basically, three groups of enzymes we have coming out of the pancreas. We have pancreatic amylase, and those are to help chemically digest our carbohydrates. We have pancreatic lipases that are to digest, of course, lipids. And we have proteases, which I'm sure you can take a wild guess, that those are enzymes that help digest proteins. Your book kind of goes off here a little bit. There's all kind of proteases, but this is a survey course, and I only want you to know one specific example of a protease, and that is trypsin. The reason is, if you go further on into healthcare, you'll see how trypsin will kind of come back over and over again in certain scenarios in real life and in research as well. So I do want you to know trypsin is a specific pancreatic protease. So it's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, look at the big picture. For my course, you have three food groups. You have carbohydrates, you have lipids, and you have proteins. And the pancreas has an enzyme for each major food group. While you're thinking about that, maybe taking notes, I want to talk to you about a disease you'll see no matter where you're in healthcare. You may even know someone who's had it. It's called pancreatitis. That is a disease where the pancreas, of course, gets inflamed. There are different reasons. Common reasons include alcoholism. Another reason is a gallstone. That's right. If you look back to that picture a couple slides ago where the common bile duct and the pancreatic duct came together, a gallstone could get wedged there and block off the pancreatic duct as well and sort of cause, if you will, backup into the pancreas. Sometimes we never find a reason for pancreatitis, but it's important to know it is a potentially lethal disorder. You'll be trained how to detect it and to treat it properly, and you will save their lives. This reminds me of a true story. I was doing a surgical rotation, and the chief surgical attending said to his residents and fellows, if anybody ever misses a case of a pancreatitis, I will fire you on the spot. Because it's easy to detect. When someone comes in the ER with what's called severe or acute belly pain, did you ever notice on all the TV, medical shows, that's a stat consult. The surgeon comes rushing down. All sorts of things better be going through your mind Because your job, remember, is don't kill the patient. If it's a woman, you better think, are they pregnant? Are they having a rupturing ectopic pregnancy? Of course, you'll all think of appendicitis. You'll all think of gallbladder disease, maybe a rupturing aneurysm, and so forth. One thing on your list better be pancreatitis. And the way you detect it is with a simple stat blood test. Because in pancreatitis, these enzymes leak out of the pancreas and find their way into the bloodstream. Mark my words, you will measure a serum amylase and a serum lipase in your suspected pancreatitis patients. You make the diagnosis, you give them the appropriate treatment, and you save their life. Sure enough, about 2 months later, I went down to the ER with the chief surgical resident. He saw a patient with acute abdominal pain. He said, oh, you got a bellyache, take some Tums. The patient came in the next day, was almost dead due to pancreatitis, and he got fired on the spot. Could you imagine going through like 30 years of training, all the money invested, all the time invested, getting in maybe a choice residency program and getting fired on the spot? That's exactly what happened. I'll give you some more clinical applications here. Some people have pancreatic disease from other things as well, cancer, cystic fibrosis. And to save their lives, you have to supplement them with all these enzymes. The body can't live without the pancreas and its bag of enzymes. So there are supplements. There's actually a pill. You can do an internet search. And the pancreatic pill is called something like amylase lipase protease pancreatic pill. I'm not making it up. Look that up. That's how you keep them alive. Some people who also knew some basic AMP knowledge, like lipases help digest lipids, have invented medications to help with weight loss. There are pills, you can look them up too, that specifically knock back or block partially our lipases. If we can't digest our fats, we can't absorb our fats. And that helps some people with severe weight loss to lose weight. So, yes, this is real stuff, and you will see it in the real world. How does the pancreas know what to do? It all boils down to remembering the three phases of digestion. Specifically, circle this. Secretin and CCK are secreted during the intestinal phase of digestion. You shove the whopper here in the duodenum and the enteroendocrine cells of the intestine release our magical, powerful hormones called secretin and CCK. You gotta know it. Here's how it goes. Secretin tells the pancreas, start secretin first. Juice that's rich in bicarbonate buffer ions. Why do I want you at least to remember it that way? Because first we have to buffer the acid from the stomach or the enzymes won't work. So just as a memorization technique, say secretin starts the pancreas first, secretin buffer. Then comes CCK, cholecystokinin. CCK then says, okay, the coast is clear. We buffered the acid. Now I will tell the pancreas to release its juices that are rich in digestive enzymes. My little mnemonic device for myself here is CCK has three letters, and there are basically just three digestive enzymes from the pancreas, if you remember. So that's how I remember CCK. Releases the three groups of pancreatic digestive enzymes. Now we move on to some of our other accessory digestive organs, the liver and the gallbladder. Take a look at this anatomy drawing off to your left. I want you to think of the liver and gallbladder kind of as a combo deal, combo package, because anatomically and physiologically, certainly there's a lot of interrelations between the two. Let's do the liver first. Here it is, underneath the diaphragm. It is the largest gland in the body. That sounds like a question someone might ask you. Is it the largest organ in the body? And the answer is no, because you remember from AMP earlier studies that the skin is the largest organ in the body. For our course, let's just say there are two lobes of the liver, a big, huge, honking lobe on the right and a smaller lobe on the left. As a matter of fact, the right lobe of the liver is so big, it actually causes another organ in our body on the right side to be lower than its counterpart on the left. It just so turns out the right kidney is pushed lower than the left kidney in our body. So if you're going into radiology or ultrasonography and you see that the kidney on the right is lower than the left, that almost is always normal. Don't tell Mr. Jones his kidney's falling out, because it's probably just normal. Gallbladder location is here, tucked underneath and a little bit posterior to the right lobe of the liver. We'll take a look at some histology on this slide. This should be familiar to you from lab. But a short summary. What they did here, took a hunk out of the liver, sucked it out, blew it up real big in a drawing. And classically, the liver has been described of consisting of these roughly six-sided units called lobules. And then they took a lobule and then they blew it up even bigger down and to your right. And the lobules are made up of rows or plates of liver cells called hepatocytes. Cyte, of course, means cell. Hepato means liver. Know your root word hepato, because there's hepatitis, hepatovax, hepatologist, and it all refers to liver something or other. And all those hepatocytes are arranged around a vein in the center that some genius called the central vein. In between the rows of hepatocytes are these blood-filled kind of leaky venous channels called sinusoids. Again, they're just capillaries between the plates of liver cells. Something we didn't tell you in lab is in those sinusoids are these special cells that look like they're kind of green here on the slide. Those are called Kupffer cells. Kupffer is fun to say, and it's fun to try to spell too. All they are is Pac-Man cells. They're macrophages in the sinusoids that gobble up worn-out blood cells, microbes, and any other foreign junk that doesn't belong there. So Kupffer cells clean out the crud in the liver. There's a little tongue twister for you to remember. This slide is critical. You don't know how the liver works unless you know the blood supply. And that applies to many organs in anatomy. We must know the blood supply. Check it out. Over to your left, there's a flow chart kind of a deal. Then off to the right, we got the words. But I'm going to really explain it in detail on a picture slide just because I like pictures. But do whichever one works best for you. Notice right off the bat, the liver special, it has a dual blood supply. And that hooks into something clinically significant. If you understand the big picture that the liver has a really vast and rich blood supply, you understand why a lot of tumors metastasize to the liver, because it has lots of blood vessels taking it that direction. Let's break it down. We have a hepatic artery taking nice red oxygenated blood from the aorta, shooting it into the liver sinusoids, where it can then bathe the liver cells with a nice fresh oxygenated blood that they need to survive so they can do their job. Then we have the Mac Daddy of them all. We have what's called the hepatic portal vein. You got to say all three words to be correct. Notice what this major vessel does in the human body. It brings blue deoxygenated blood from the spleen, but more importantly, nutrient-rich blood from the stomach and from the intestines, and also whatever else we ingested from our stomach and intestines, such as drugs, toxins, microbes, and they all go through that vein from our guts, get delivered to the liver, and again dumped into the liver sinusoids, where the magical liver cells can work on those nutrients, drugs, and toxins. The rest of this flow chart, you have to remember it, but it should be a little bit of review from earlier studies of your blood vessels. From the liver sinusoids, the blood goes to the central vein, then it goes to the hepatic vein, then the inferior vena cava, then the right atrium of the heart, and then round and round and round she goes. Let's stop here and notice the beauty of a portal vein. There's not a whole lot of portal veins in the body. We'll only talk about two, and this is one of them. Definition of a portal vein: carries blood from a capillary network in one part of the body to a capillary network in another part of the body without passing through the heart first. That is different, and that is weird, isn't it? Let's picture, for example, my hand is an organ. And let's take blood from an artery down to that organ and to a capillary network in my hand. Then that comes what? Out of a vein, and then the vein goes back to the heart, and then round and round and round she goes. It doesn't go from a capillary network in my hand to the capillary network in my other hand. It goes through the heart first, normally. What's the purpose? The design matches the mission. You should write it down here, and we'll see it again later. A portal vein is quicker, it's safer, and it's more efficient. Here's the example I like to give. Let's say the intestines are New Jersey. And I don't, it's no offense to anybody in New Jersey. I grew up on the Jersey Shore. So in New Jersey, there's lots of good stuff, fruits and vegetables, but there's also toxins. Let's say you wanted to get all those ingredients to the processing plant, to the factory, to the liver, which is in Cleveland. Would you want to take your dump truck to Toledo, then Topeka, then Sacramento, and then to Houston, and then to Cleveland? Of course not, because along the way, what's happening? You'd be dumping off some good stuff, you'd be losing some of the fruits and vegetables, and you'd be contaminating the whole rest of the country. So you want to get a direct shot from the intestines where the ingredients are to the factory, right, in Cleveland, which is the liver. That's the processing plant. So that's the beauty of a portal vein. This is a picture from the vessel chapter in your book. It's showing you in blue all the vessels from the spleen and, more importantly, the digestive organs heading right to the liver through the hepatic portal vein. I love this slide. What they did was take a liver lobule, they took a piece of it and blew it up really big. This is a great place to review anatomy and physiology. On this slide, I want you to be the liver so you can understand it deeply. Here's a summary. First of all, we have these nice orangish liver cells called hepatocytes. In between, we have the blood-filled capillaries, really called sinusoids. There's the cute little Kupffer cells ready to clean the crud out. Here's the central vein in the middle. Now we move our attention to something new, and it is key. Over here with stars and arrows and red boxes is something called a portal triad. Classically, at the corners of the lobules, we have a collection of three tubular structures that someone called the portal triad. Why? Triad means three, and there are three things here you got to know. Portal, well, there's a portal vein in there, but I just kind of remember these three things are transporting stuff. So we got three things transporting stuff in the portal triad. Let's look at them one at a time. Here's the breakdown. First, hepatic artery bringing red oxygenated blood to the liver cells to give them the oxygen they need. Also, as the blood's flowing through, it's getting cleaned by the Kupffer cells. Then, hepatic portal, underline it, vein, is bringing the blue, deoxygenated, nutrient-rich blood with whatever else you ate, drugs, toxins, and bacteria, delivers it again to the liver into the sinusoid where Kupffer cells can clean the crud. Also, more importantly, the liver cells can do their metabolic magic. They can deal with the nutrients. They can deal with the drugs and toxins and do the processing. And then, hopefully, when the blood gets through here to the central vein, it is nice and clean and has the proper ingredients in it. And then it goes up to the hepatic vein, and on she goes. Third thing in the portal triad shown here in green is the bile duct. You got it. It carries bile. One of the key functions of these liver cells is to produce and secrete bile, and it makes their way into these bile ducts. Notice the flow of bile is the opposite of the direction of flow of blood through the lobule, so I shoved in a little red arrow of my own just to demonstrate that. The key is, be the liver. Tell yourself that little story. I love this slide. You just don't know how important bile is to the body, so check this out. One of the main functions of the liver is to produce and secrete bile. What is it? Generally yellow, brown, or greenish color, mostly in the green range, but more importantly has that alkaline pH. Here we go again, shooting our bile juice and pancreatic juice right where it belongs, the top of the small intestine, neutralizing the acidic chyme from the stomach as soon as it hits the duodenum. Beautiful setup. What's inside bile? Okay, you could always say water. That's a no-brainer. But three goodies I want you to know. Cholesterol with a star. I've got a lot to say about that later. But what's kind of interesting to talk about here is when your liver puts cholesterol into the bile, of course, it gets shot into the food chute and, you know, goes out the body. So this is one way your body regulates cholesterol. Puts it in the bile, shoots it out the food chute. What about bile salts with a star? Mark it down here, even though it's labeled later. Bile salts are absolutely mandatory to both digest and absorb your fats. You cannot do either without bile salts. They do double duty. It's a key ingredient of your bile. Third thing I want you to know from my course is the principal bile pigment that gives it its color, and it is bilirubin. You remember your red blood cells only last about 120 days, then they start to disintegrate, and those pieces would cause all kinds of problems if you didn't clean it up, so to speak. One of the things you got to do is you got to get that bilirubin out of there. Your liver takes the bilirubin out of the blood, puts it into the bile, so you could put it in your food chute and get it out of your body. What about the gallbladder here before I tell you a few more details? Gallbladder, again, that sac tucked up and a little bit behind that big right lobe of the liver. It just holds, concentrates, and releases bile when called upon. In other words, it just holds the bile and squirts it out when you need it. If I ask you on a test, what does the bile create? What does it synthesize? What does it produce or secrete? It doesn't make diddly squat. It just holds the bile it got from the liver and squirts it out when called upon. That's it. Let's do some clinical stuff. What are gallstones? Well, they're stones that develop inside the biliary system, often in the gallbladder itself. You'll see usually it's women, usually over 40, and they're usually overweight. They'll come in the ER and say, every time I have a fatty meal, I get a bellyache. In other words, I don't get digestion, I get indigestion. Why? Because that gallbladder is usually trying to contract after a fatty meal like it's supposed to, squirt in its bile salts to digest the fats. But they can't do that. So they get indigestion. That hurts. It also hurts when you try to squeeze the gallbladder against a blocked duct that has a sharp stone lodged in it. So you will see those patients and you'll lop their gallbladder out. It's thought that, by the way, the gallstones are often due to an improper proportion of these ingredients. Specifically, if there's too high of a cholesterol concentration in the bile, it tends to crystallize out into these stones that we call gallstones. No better time than now to talk about pale and greasy stools. What about pale stools? You'll see your patients every once in a while might have a white-colored stool. That's right. My baby, one time, he had a white, chalk-white bowel movement. And, of course, I'm thinking the worst because there's too much stuff in my brain. And I think, oh, my gosh, my baby's liver failure. So I rush my baby to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician says, most likely, it is just a virus The virus affected the liver. It temporarily stunned the liver. The liver's not putting the bilirubin in the bile, so the bowel movements don't look brown. Calm down. The liver will recover, and the brown color will come back. And he was exactly right. But you should just know the big picture. If someone's bowel movements are not brown and they're missing the pigment, something might be wrong with the liver gallbladder combo package. What about greasy stools? Well, look, we talked the bile salts are mandatory to digest and absorb fats. So if something's wrong with the liver gallbladder combo and someone can't digest and absorb their fats, well, the fat comes out, it slip slides out, and it looks like in their bowel movements they got little chunks of chicken fat in there, and you'll see that too. And when you see that, the key is, because you're learning and understanding this stuff, you're going to say, hey, something might be wrong with the liver-gallbladder combo package. And you'll do your test to try to figure out what's wrong, and you'll try to do something, of course, to help them. That reminds me, not too long ago, someone came up with this idea, hey, I know people who want to go on a diet and they want to eat fatty foods but don't want to gain weight from fat. I will make a fake fat that bile salts and lipases can't digest. So they came up with this fake fat a while ago called Olestra. And I'm not kidding. On the package of potato chips that contained Olestra, it used to say, caution may cause anal leakage. That's right, because your normal digestive juices couldn't digest the fake fat, you know, which helped the patient maybe lose weight. But the problem is, since you couldn't digest it, it could just slip slide on out. They changed the wording on the warning label, but that was the old warning label. Also want to mention jaundice. You should know about jaundice. What is jaundice? That's when people turn yellow, right? Why do they turn yellow? Because the bilirubin's too high in their blood. And again, there's all different reasons for jaundice. You'll learn them. But one of the reasons might be you're thinking, hey, liver gallbladder combo package may have a problem here. I should probably test it and find out. Then there's babies born with jaundice called neonatal jaundice. A little bit is not unusual. It tends to come and go. But some babies have severe jaundice, and it can even kill the baby. There's a disorder you can do an internet search on called Kernicterus, Kernicterus, I believe. That is a potentially deadly type of jaundice. So what do they do, by the way? One of the things they'll do, you notice in the baby unit, I'll call it, is they'll put the baby under the blue light, right? That blue-green light spectrum detoxifies, so to speak, the bilirubin. Remember, the baby has really thin skin, and the capillaries are right under the thin skin, so the blue light gets to the blood and changes the bilirubin into a different form that doesn't cause damage. And when the baby goes home, you may have heard this too, they tell the mama, you know, put your baby in a bassinet somewhere, you know, near the window or near the sunlight. Same for the same idea, same reason. The underlying story here is, the baby's liver at birth is not always fully developed. It's not always functioning to, you know, the maximum capacity. That's why some babies have neonatal jaundice. This should make sense to you. I don't want you just to learn and memorize the parts. I want you to understand, synthesize, and apply this material. We have to do the flow of bile. It's one of those things where I could ask you to put it in the right order. Sort of boring to talk about, but this is a flow chart. I'm not a big flow chart person, but you can memorize it using this flow chart. I'm going to do the same exact thing using pictures. So here's a big picture, the whole deal. Here we go. Bile made by the right lobe of the liver goes through the right hepatic duct. That just means the right liver duct. Bile made in the left lobe of the liver flows through the left hepatic duct. Where they join it together, they call that the common hepatic duct, or the common liver duct is what that translates to. Then notice, here's our little gallbladder bag. Looks like a little cyst, doesn't it? That's how I remember the duct coming from the gallbladder is the cystic duct. The cystic duct joins with the common hepatic duct and forms what is finally known as the common bile duct. And again, the magic anatomy here is the common bile duct and the pancreatic duct join together, dump all their beautiful juices right where they belong, in the first part, the top of the small intestine, called the duodenum, where they could do their work. Then I should be able to ask you a critical thinking question. Some people have their gallbladders removed. It's called a cholecystectomy. Can the patient still produce and secrete bile? The answer is yes, because the liver produces and secretes it. Can they still get the bile from the liver to the duodenum? Answer is still yes, because when you do the surgery to lop out a gallbladder, you just clip the cystic duct and take this little puppy out. You shouldn't be clipping the common hepatic duct or the common bile duct. That's a big no-no. So you still could make the bile and you still could deliver it into the duodenum. Now look, after the surgery, you could still digest some fatty foods, but it's not quite the same as it used to be. So you can't just go out and have 12 Whoppers anymore, for example. How does the liver gallbladder combo package know what to do? Here comes again the all-powerful hormones, secretin and CCK, which you must know are secreted during the most important intestinal phase of digestion. Here's how it goes. Secretin tells the liver, start secreting bile. That's easier for my pea brain to remember. And CCK tells the gallbladder, start contracting. For some reason, again, my pea brain makes the word contract out of the initial CCK. So CCK tells the gallbladder, start squishing out the bile. Give me an extra dose of the juice. At the bottom of the slide, I posed a question. Could you summarize what secretin and CCK do in the GI tract? If you've been paying attention, you notice that those all-powerful hormones have basically told every part of our guts what to do. We've already answered these questions, by the way, so yes, you should be able to summarize it in the future if anybody should ask you. Now the liver. More functions of the liver. The liver is a metabolic powerhouse. It does thousands of things. You could study the liver for 2 years. Some doctors become liver doctors called hepatologists, but we only have one day to do it, so to speak. So I'm going to boil it down. Don't get nervous on this slide. I know a lot of you are looking at it and saying, oh my gosh, there's like 8 bullet points on this slide. Calm down. Let's look at it together. I'm going to draw a line right here just below the top 5 bullet points. Because you already know it, don't you? Number 1, does the liver detoxify the blood? We already mentioned that. It does. Number 2, bullet point, drugs and hormones in the body, do they get processed in the liver? We already mentioned that as well. So that's not anything new to remember. There is a star there, however. And I want you to make a mental note of this. Before you give any drug to any patient, you better ask them what the status of their liver is, because many drugs are metabolized through the liver. And if they have liver damage and you give them certain drugs, you can cause them serious harm. I'll tell you a real life story on that in a different unit. What about bullet point number 3? Does the liver phagocytize worn out blood cells and bacteria? We already said that too. That's nothing new. The Kupffer cells clean the crud out of the blood. Does that remind you of another organ? It should, and it's fair game for me to ask you right here, right now. The spleen, I hope, is what came to all of your minds. The spleen filters blood. As a matter of fact, when you take out the spleen in your trauma patients, the liver can take up the slack in this department, because those disintegrating red blood cells, again, they have waste products. Some of those waste products would actually block up our kidneys. Some of those waste products like bilirubin from the dead red blood cells can harm us as well through jaundice, as we've mentioned. So bullet point number 4 is also old. Bullet point number 5 is not new either. Yes, the liver makes bile salts, and we cannot digest or absorb our fats without bile salts. Little clinical correlation there. Someone who took anatomy and knew this said, well, people who maybe have real high lipid levels in the blood, maybe I can make a drug that counteracts bile salts. And sure enough, this is beyond the scope of this course, but there's drugs called bile salt sequestrants. That means the drugs basically bind up to the bile salts so they can't do their job. And that helps the person lower their lipid levels, maybe lose weight, all because they can't digest and absorb their fats as well because of the design of the drug. Now we get to the meat of this slide. After all, this is the digestive unit, isn't it? We must talk about carbohydrate, lipid, and protein metabolism. Underline it, bold print it, and it's triple stars. You've got to know it. Remember, for my course, I'm keeping it easy. These are the three major food groups. Make yourself a little chart here. I want you to divide into three sections, have three headings. Start with carbohydrates at the top left, maybe. Specifically, I want to talk about glucose metabolism. Three things you should know your liver does. Number one, your liver can store the glucose it receives as glycogen. So your liver is a storehouse for sugar as glycogen. Number two function, your liver can release glucose from glycogen and give it to your body cells as they need it. And number three, the liver is so smart and spectacular that it can make new glucose from scratch, so to speak. So three key functions in the carbohydrate column. Next, let's go to the lipid column. Specifically, I want you to know about cholesterol. Let's write two things down under lipids. Number one, your liver can decide to put excess cholesterol into your bile, which goes into the food chute and out of your body. In other words, your liver can get rid of excess cholesterol by shooting it out through the bile. Function number two, your liver can produce cholesterol and give it to body cells when and where it is needed. Cholesterol gets such a bad rap, doesn't it? High cholesterol, bad cholesterol. Of course, high cholesterol is bad, but you need cholesterol to live. It's in your cell membranes. It's in your hormones. You need it to live. I like to ask my students in my face-to-face classes, where does most cholesterol in your body come from? When they draw that blood and they measure cholesterol level, where does most of that cholesterol come from? And almost the whole class says, in the food you eat. And that's not right. The liver makes about 2 grams of cholesterol per day. The average human being in the United States ingests about 0.5 gram of cholesterol a day. So in English, your liver makes 5 times the amount of cholesterol than you eat per day. So 2 key functions on the cholesterol column. Your liver can put it in the bile and shoot it out of the body if it wants to get rid of it, or your liver can manufacture cholesterol and give it to your cells as needed. This brings me to a clinical point. A lot of people do have too high of a cholesterol. How do they treat it? Well, there's cholesterol medications. Take a wild guess where the cholesterol medications work. They work on the liver. They monkey with the hepatocytes. They monkey with the enzymes, the metabolic machinery of the hepatocytes. That's why if you know anyone who's on those drugs and you read the package insert, it says, please go see your doctor every whatever a few months for a liver function test, because the medications monkey with the liver. Now in our protein column, I want you to write down 3 of the many proteins that the liver makes. The liver makes albumin, prothrombin, and fibrinogen. Let's talk about them one at a time. Albumin is the main plasma protein. Remember from another unit in the course, I asked you all to think of albumin in our blood, protein in our blood, like a sponge. It helps to hold the water inside our vessels where the watery plasma belongs. So people who have liver disease, they have low albumin levels in their blood, and they can't hold the water in their pipes. So what happens is the water gets out and it gets in their tissue spaces and they start to swell up like the Pillsbury Doughboy, and we call that condition edema. Write that down. E-D-E-M-A. What about prothrombin and fibrinogen? Do you remember from your earlier studies possibly that those are clotting proteins? That's right. You cannot clot your blood without those proteins from the liver. So if someone has liver failure, they can't make those proteins like they should, and they tend to bleed easier, like from their mucous membranes. So I'll give you an example of your classic liver failure patient that you will see in the hospitals. Number one, they'll be swollen with edema. Number two, they'll bleed easily, like bleeding from their gums. Next, they will have trouble controlling their cholesterol levels. Their cholesterol levels may be all over the map. They may be too high or too low. It all depends on how the liver gets affected, quite honestly. Same thing with carbohydrate metabolism. You will see your liver failure patients, they have a hard time controlling blood sugar levels. Their sugar will be all over the map. That is your classic liver failure patient. Have that mental image in your brain, and you will know a lot of what the key bullet points are on the liver. Only a couple more to go on this slide. Your liver also stores vitamins, such as vitamins D, E, A, and K. You should know those are the fat-soluble vitamins. And your liver stores minerals, including one. I just picked one, iron. How do I remember this? Because there's a lot to remember in anatomy. I remember I have a friend. His name is Iron Deke. And that reminds me, he's tough. He's tough as iron. And he's also a big fellow. That reminds me that Deke are the fat-soluble vitamins. So have a big, tough friend called Iron Deke living in the liver, and you'll remember what the liver stores. What's important to understand here, though, is anything your liver stores, you can overdose on. That's right. I'll give you an example. Some people think, hey, if I take a little bit of vitamin A, I'll have good vision. But if I take 80 vitamin A tablets a day, I'll have, you know, super duper eagle eye vision. Well, the problem is anything your liver could store, you could overdose on. In the United States of America, I never saw a case of vitamin A deficiency. But I did see vitamin A intoxication from ingesting too much. And I saw people, oddly enough, go blind from too much vitamin A. The weird thing is vitamin A toxicity can actually lead to hydrocephalus, which is high water pressure in your on your brain water, which can crush the visual pathways and cause loss of vision. Same thing with iron. Some people are told, take an iron tablet a day because you have low blood. Well, some of those people think, I'll take 20 tablets a day and I'll have Superman, you know, blood. Well, no. If you take too much iron, you can overdose on it. The liver can get damaged. The heart can get damaged. Again, anything your liver can store, you can overdose on. Last thing I want you to know is your liver is involved in the activation of vitamin D. For example, when you drink milk, the milk, of course, gets delivered to the liver through the portal vein, and the liver helps in the process of activation. The liver also will help any vitamin D that is processed from the skin. You may have heard that the skin helps to process vitamin D. It does, but it has to next go to the liver for another step in the activation process. We're just scratching the surface here. The liver is an amazing organ. I hope you really appreciate everything it can do and have understood all the clinical aspects of it. I hope what you have learned here will really serve you well in the future.